This episode is brought to you by Michigan Economic Development Corporation. In Michigan, you can have both a rewarding career and a quality lifestyle with plentiful career opportunities in world-changing, innovating industries, from electric vehicles to clean energy to biotech, with room for advancement no matter where you are in your career. Plus, Michigan offers a welcoming, beautiful, affordable, and inclusive community for all. Live your best life. You can in Michigan. Visit themichiganlife.org.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the proposal. Beyond the old chain of U.S. military bases around the world, the Pentagon is looking for something new. A new network of bases in new and less familiar locations, shaped to support special ops and intelligence and counterterrorism strikes, hubs and spokes, Djibouti, Cameroon, new reach and presence. This hour on Point, the Pentagon's wish list for a growing network of bases abroad. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time for a new string of bases to fight ISIS and more? Is this the way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And listeners, some fine news. iTunes has named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. If you miss a broadcast, our podcast is always there. Subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can link at our website, onpointradio.org. Best of 2015. We like that every year. That's good. Joining me today from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
So there are so many bases out there already. What is it that the Pentagon is looking for now, and how is it different from what's already in use?
So good question. What we've seen, and you're right, over the last 14 years is this dramatic expansion of the U.S. military's footprint around the world to basically try to fight a war across the globe in places where the United States is not officially at war.
So war as in war on terror war, I guess.
Yeah, war, exactly, against Al-Qaeda originally, and now it's kind of morphing. And so what we're seeing now is this Pentagon plan to, in a way, formalize some of what has been done in a piecemeal fashion over the last 14 years. So there are bases, for instance, you mentioned in Djibouti, in obviously Afghanistan, in northern Iraq. Some of those would become sort of more permanent bases. But you'd also see a formalization of a structure that's been very, very ad hoc, for instance, in North and West Africa. The Pentagon would base troops there on a temporary basis. They'd base material there in part to start realigning itself for ISIS, ISIS affiliates, and whatever might come in the future.
And there are addresses on here which were unfamiliar to me as footprint places for the U.S. military. Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Niger, or Niger. Am I just not up to date, Mark, or are some of those new locations proposed?
Well, some are new. Some have been used on a temporary basis by the Pentagon in the last decade. For instance, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, the Pentagon's been basing drones there surveillance drones. They're not U.S. bases. They're foreign bases that the U.S. is sort of leasing. And I think the proposal would be to, again, kind of formalize these bases as part of the U.S. military's network. And it sort of maps against what the Pentagon thinks is the threat. It's not just in the Middle East. It's growing concerns about North and West Africa, ISIS affiliates, Boko Haram in Nigeria. So it's how the Pentagon is guessing the future is going to look like and how they're going to fight it. And of course, the Pentagon will always try to dream big whenever they're thinking about trying to fight an enemy.
When we think of U.S. bases, a lot of people may think of, Japan and Germany, South Korea. I've been in all those, and the bases, they're huge facilities, many of them there. Give us a little compare and contrast those traditional post-World War II bases anyway, and what is imagined for this new string of bases, outposts, this new network?
Well, it's some of it's still trying to be worked out. It's already some of these proposed hub bases, for instance, in Djibouti, are already very built up bases. I was in Djibouti to see that base in 2003, and it was this sort of ramshackle former French Foreign Legion base that the U.S. had taken over, and now is this dramatically larger, much more built up American base that where the U.S. intends to stay. But then these smaller so-called spoke bases, which could be in Niger, could be in Cameroon, would not necessarily permanently house thousands of troops, but they could house troops on a temporary basis. For instance, special operations troops could house drones, intelligence operatives for months or even years at a time, not tens of thousands, but possibly even thousands. And this would be the Pentagon sees it as a way to move forces more quickly, station them in better places that are closer to evolving threats.
Describe the range of operations that are imagined out of this particular new expansion. What's the focus of these, or the primary function or functions of these? What would it be as the Pentagon's envisioning this?
As it is envisioned right now, it would be, as you described in the beginning, use of special operations troops to possibly either gather intelligence, to go into countries like Libya, to go into places in northern Nigeria, to gather intelligence, to do strikes, to kill suspected militant leaders, to do quick operations and then come back, but do them from a location where they wouldn't have to come, for instance, from Sicily, which has been a staging base for special operations for some time. And those who know the story of Benghazi in all its complicated facets know that there were base troops stationed in Sicily at the time, and there was this question about whether they could get there in time or not. Partly the idea is that the Pentagon is going to be closer to where future Benghazis might happen.
With hubs and spokes. Hubs a little bit bigger. Spokes would be smaller, could be in Cameroon or Niger. Does this signal a change in type of operation, or a pickup in the tempo of operation, or an acknowledgement that ISIS / threats are spreading, so there needs to be more U.S. presence? What's the signal in this?
I think it's all of those things, Tom. I think it's the final thing, of course, is this question of ISIS affiliates and the threat. And Secretary of Defense Ash Carter talked about it last week in response to a question about this new base structure, about how the Pentagon needs to evolve as the ISIS threat is evolving. But it's also, I think, this recognition that any plans the military, the Obama administration had a couple years ago about increasing or decreasing the military's footprint, to some extent, have kind of gone out the window. It was only a couple years ago we were talking about this full pullout of Afghanistan within, a year. But what's kind of quietly being reoriented here is the possibility that Afghanistan could be one of these hubs that has this enduring military presence, not necessarily to fight in Afghanistan, but to fight in Central Asia and South Asia. And so you don't hear the White House talking about that aspect of it. But they are trying to sort of rethink what the next 10 years or so are going to look like.
We heard, of course, President Obama just yesterday. He went to the Pentagon for a strategy session there and spoke afterward about the difficult fight with what he calls ISIL.
This continues to be a difficult fight. As I said before, ISIL is dug in, including in urban areas, and they hide behind civilians, using defenseless men, women, and children as human shields.
People looking for a way to get a handle on that. Here was Defense Secretary Ash Carter. This was at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington back in October, talking about the military maintaining bases in locations abroad, what might be needed.
Because we cannot predict the future, these regional nodes from Maroun, Spain to Jalalabad, Afghanistan, will provide forward presence to respond to a range of crises, terrorists and other kinds. These will enable unilateral crisis response, counter-terror operations, or strikes on high-value targets.
Unilateral crisis response, counter-terror operations, strikes on high-value targets from what he calls their regional nodes that is firming up. This is not approved, as I understand it, yet by the White House. What about the cost of this, Mark? I was struck by how low the numbers are that are being floated out there in the matter of, in the range of just single millions for here and there. We have the sense of the U.S. military not doing anything that costs single millions.
Yeah, and I think you could probably always assume that that number is going to grow and that it will be more expensive than some of what the Pentagon is envisioning now. It kind of has to be. It also depending on what sort of the size of the troop numbers that are stationed in these places. As you said, it's something that becomes sort of a way for the Pentagon to formalize something that has been to some degree piecemeal over the years. I thought it was pretty striking yesterday. You played a clip of President Obama's speech, and he's doing a number of these speeches and will do another visit to the National Counterterrorism Center later this week. And it was a very militaristic speech yesterday, maybe befitting the president speaking at the Pentagon. He was talking about number of bombs dropped on ISIS. He was talking about territory gained, number of leaders killed. And it's, some might question, is that any kind of, metric for judging the success of this kind of operation? But the president is obviously trying to convey some sense of progress. And I think the White House is trying to feel its way around, try to setting the right tone to try to deal with people's concerns about ISIS.
I mean, we understand operations and proximity, but as I listen to all this, I'm also very much reminded of Colin Powell back in the day. So, you break it, you own it. I mean, you might say you have a base in it. You have some responsibility for it. Is the U.S. taking on new responsibility and an approach to all these problems by extending physical presence?
Sure. I mean, it's certainly a big change from what the Obama administration was envisioning during its first term, which was going after al-Qaeda, specifically in Pakistan, but then letting other countries, letting other partners deal with threats in regional places. If it didn't affect the United States or United States' interest, then you would let other countries deal with it. This is a much more expansive set of responsibilities. And this should also be pointed out that it's not without its critics. This is not approved yet by the White House. As we reported last week, there's concerns, especially in the State Department, that this is a Pentagon that's once again trying to establish its supremacy in American foreign policy. You've seen the Pentagon ascendant over the last 14 years since 9/11, and the State Department feels like it's getting muscled out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Pentagon's proposed new string of military bases from Africa, across the Middle East, and into Asia, the new envisioned enduring footprint of the U.S. military, kind of a string of bases, network of bases, new, expanded, around the world, some in quite new territory for the United States with this kind of operation. Mark Mazzetti is with us, national security correspondent for the New York Times. He's been reporting on this, the Pentagon's wish list. The White House has not signed off yet, but the president being much tougher in his language in recent days. A new sound from President Obama yesterday here at the Pentagon.
We are hitting ISIL harder than ever. Coalition aircraft, our fighters, bombers, and drones have been increasing the pace of airstrikes, nearly 9,000 as of today. Last month in November, we dropped more bombs on ISIL targets than any other month since this campaign started.
And you got to be close to the action for precision, the president said at the Pentagon yesterday.
Even as we're relentless, we have to be smart, targeting ISIL surgically with precision. At the same time, our partners on the ground are rooting ISIL out town by town, neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block. That is what this campaign is doing.
Neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block. The Pentagon watching all this, what's being asked, and saying we need more presence. This is a theme that's been around, their sense of things at risk. Benghazi made that painfully clear. In January of this year, he had General David Rodriguez, commander of U.S. Africa Command, known as AFRICOM. He was at the Center for Strategic and International Studies talking about challenges and vulnerabilities the U.S. military faces in Africa.
15 U.S. embassies and consulates designed as high risk or high threat are in the Africa Command area of responsibility, and 9 of the United Nations' 16 peacekeeping missions are located in Africa. Infrastructure is limited across much of the continent, presenting both opportunities and challenges for development and security. Looking across this vast and complex landscape, our African partners and the international community face several challenges.
New challenges. Infrastructure is limited. That's an opportunity and a challenge, says the head of U.S. AFRICOM right there. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Do you see the need for a new string of U.S. military outposts, bases? Do you want a more forward posture on ISIS and more by the U.S. military? Should the U.S. military be leading here? Vets, servicemen, women, what do you see? Vikram Singh and David Vine join us in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Jan, Mason City, Iowa. Jan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for this important topic today. I have read that there are 1,400 military bases around the world. In the 90s, I read it was in blowback. Chalmers Johnson said there were 960, so that's 500 in rather short period of time. My neighbors have kids who are in the military. One of them works heavy construction material. He's in the Air Force. Every time I talk to them, he's building a new place somewhere around the world, one in South Israel, and now on the Turkey border with Syria.
Building. As Mark Mazzetti says, there's been a big expansion, especially in the last 14 years. No question about it. Jan, I appreciate your call. There, a neighbor's son out there working around the world, building more. Question is it time for a new expansion of that number? Maybe some new places. Mark Mazzetti, standby in Washington. I want to look more closely at this. With us from Leesburg, Virginia today is Vikram Singh. He's Vice President of National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia at the Pentagon, former Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan at the State Department. He's been in the thick of it. Vikram Singh, thank you very much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be with you. Thanks.
David Vine joins us in just a moment, but first, your reaction to this. Given what we're seeing with ISIS, given what we're seeing in the global security environment, is this necessary? Is this inevitable? Is this a step on the right strategy, or does it put the U.S. in harm's way and responsibility around the American neck? Is it the right approach?
Well, I think it certainly could be part of the right approach. Being closer to where bad things are happening can help you be much more effective. I think Mark mentioned earlier about the Benghazi response being part of the motivation for this. The fact is there were not forces there close enough by to be able to respond very quickly. So I think that saying, hey, there's some places where it would be useful to have more people present who could partner with locals who are fighting serious problems in their own countries and be available for rapid reaction or to respond to an opportunity could be good. The key would be for it to be a part of some overall whole-of-government strategy between the United States and the partners that are going to be hosting these forces. You don't sort of want to just sort of have a fire and forget of dropping a bunch of folks out there to hopefully do good things. It really needs to be part of an integrated plan, and that's something we know how to do. There are examples of us doing that in many places around the world. The other thing I would say is it isn't very new. Most of the places we're talking about already have a U.S. presence, and it's really the kind of thing the United States has done for a long, long time, which has, on balance, been good for international security. The problem has been our major large-scale military operations, much more than our smaller-scale partnerships with other countries.
Can you just give us a physical picture of what these might be like? I mean, I think a lot of Americans, still they have images of, you know, Ramstein Air Base in Japan or something in Yokohama or Guam, big, big facilities. But here we're talking single millions in cost as described per year. It sounds like a tent and a pump.
Yeah, I would have to agree with Mark also. I don't know of anything in my time in the Pentagon or very few things that cost in the single millions. So I expect that if this is really permanently putting more folks out there, there would be higher costs, but they would be identifiable and certainly far less expensive than, sort of large-scale invasions or occupations. So this is going to be something that's quite affordable. I think we're talking about fairly small locations, except Djibouti has been a large outpost for the U.S. military for many, many years. But we have a lot of places where we do have small presence. I mean, think of places like Kosovo. Americans forget. We still have several hundred troops in Kosovo. NATO still has over 4,000 troops in Kosovo, 15 years on. Those are the kinds of things that are steady state, that help contribute to security for a partner, and that really don't make the news a lot. And we have a couple of military installations there, and I imagine these would be things that look more like that.
Mark Mazzetti, I've been surprised sometimes in my travels and reporting, you run into military or military contractors in places you don't expect it, Rwanda or you name it. But lately, some of the addresses on this list, I mean, I wasn't really focused on U.S. facilities or operations out of Bulgaria, out of Kenya. What goes on out of places like that?
Well, for Kenya specifically, there's the threat of militancy in East Africa that's been a concern. So you have some of what the military does is follow the overall U.S. presence in a place. So, for instance, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi is huge, and it's a sort of hub for military and intelligence and diplomatic activities around East Africa. So Kenya has long been a hub for the United States because it's seen as a relatively stable country in a volatile part of the world, and so therefore it becomes a kind of likely hub. And so,
but what does a hub mean exactly, Mark?
Well,
do we have a delineated base there? Do we have part of a Kenyan military facility that we share or use, or what does it mean?
The U.S. Special Forces have been using, for instance, Navy SEALs have been using a coastal base in Kenya for some period of time to do operations into Somalia. There are other U.S. military installations or installations the U.S. military uses in southern Kenya. So some of these are not well advertised at all or not advertised, and some are still clandestine, but they are used and have been used by the military for some time.
Vikram Singh, you know, I've seen the UN go in to pull out of Somalia there in Mogadishu and a lot more. What about other American locations that might surprise Americans who are paying for and trying to keep track of what's going on?
Well, I think again, it's a lot of these are tiny, dozens of folks. So in Kenya, the U.S. military helps to train Kenyan forces, and in particular helps to train Kenyan forces that contribute to African Union troops that are going to do things like operations in Somalia. There's been a big evolution where regional actors are able and willing to do more to provide security in their own neighborhoods, but they need assistance that really can only come from countries with much more developed militaries and greater capabilities. And so the U.S. military trains the African Union troops that Kenya will send in a peace support school in Nairobi. I don't know how many people are in a place like that, but it'll be, you know, a handful, and that'll be well integrated with what we're doing through the embassy. And you know, in general, those are the types of things that I think Americans should feel pretty good about us doing. It's cost-effective. It's helping others take care of their own problems rather than going in and trying to do it ourselves. And it can be very smart. It can also be mishandled. And so it comes down to the question of what's the strategy for what you're doing in these places.
That's the question. I mean, that sounds all right. At the same time, we prick up our ears when Mark talks about Navy SEAL base on the coast of Kenya, just looking for a little transparency enough to understand what's happening with American policy, American posture around the world. Challenges are obvious. Alan in Montgomery, Alabama. Alan, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, I think it's a good idea for small-scale bases to go up. Scale back on the larger bases. Our special ops seem to do a better job at getting the job done than these large-scale invasions like in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. So you're for it. You're in sort of military country there. Does it sound like the kind of thing that you would feel support for among U.S. military members?
I believe so. I think the military members here would support it.
Of course, they've got to do the work, and a base may help them do that work. Alan, I appreciate your call. I want to go, if I may, right now to David Vine. He is author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. Joins us today from Vicenza, Italy. David Vine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
How do you look at this new network? Not all of these are new sites, but it's being revisualized and proposed for beefing up to put more special ops and intelligence and counterstrike, counterterrorism strike capacity very forward. How do you look at this, David?
I'm much more skeptical about this plan. I do agree with Vikram that there's nothing very new about this plan. Most of the bases have long been in existence. And in fact, we've been building up bases in the greater Middle East and the areas under consideration since 1980. initially to fight the Cold War, to defend against the Soviet Union, and then built up a even larger collection of bases beginning in 2001, 2002 for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think, frankly, we should be downsizing this, you know, massive infrastructure of near 100 bases by my count, again, in the areas under consideration, rather than thinking about expanding them.
Maybe this is a kind of downsizing, David. You heard our Alabama caller saying, let's have smaller special ops bases instead of big old, heavy-duty ones. Maybe it is a downsizing in a way.
I might support some plan along those lines, but I've heard no talk of downsizing. I've only heard talk of integrating these bases and expanding. I think the estimate of, you know, that both Vikram and Mark referred to, the low millions, is laughable and frankly, you know, dangerous, and should be a warning that you know what might happen is that the essentially the Pentagon is lowballing, and that the costs will expand dramatically over time as bases expand dramatically over time.
Mark Mazzetti with the New York Times, you've been reporting on this. Take us back to what is new here. We're hearing, you know, Vikram and David say, well, a lot of these locations have already been used. So what exactly is the new angle of the Pentagon push?
Part of it is looking at how these things that have expanded haphazardly over the last 14 years can connect to each other, I think, is part of what it is. Now, right after 9/11, I think we should go back and sort of explain what happened right after 9/11. 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, envisioned that the military is going to be need to be at war all over the place to fight al-Qaeda. And he tried to develop a new strategy. He tried to develop a new network. He saw special operations being used more. But this was not done in any kind of a strategic manner. So you saw the U.S. military obviously go into Afghanistan. You saw the Iraq War. You saw operations in Somalia. So with those operations that happened obviously in Yemen, the U.S. set up bases. And Djibouti, as we've all agreed, became this central hub for the military, but there's been others. And so now I think what's happening is that the bases that have come up over the last 14 years, the Pentagon is looking to see how they could possibly keep them and have them fit with the others. And some that really are small but are not entirely new, for instance, as we talked about Niger, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, the U.S. military wants to stay there or at least have access to them in the future. So I think we're all agreeing that this is not necessarily the U.S. military going out and breaking ground in a lot of new places, but it is a way to keep a more permanent presence in these places where they've already set a sort of toehold.
David Vine, what's the difference between a base and what the military calls a lily pad?
Very little, and I think the distinction is not very helpful. I think the language of lily pad bases and cooperative security locations is usually employed to disguise the presence of bases. We should remember that no country on the African continent was willing to host the Africa Command. So largely the military has used a variety of covers to build up a quite dramatic presence. Again, most of the bases are small with the exception of Djibouti, but if you look across the continent, it is quite dramatic presence now. And the track record of the Africa Command, we should also remember, is really quite appalling. The training that Vikram referred to has trained several African militaries that have gone on to overthrow democratically elected governments, the humanitarian operations that AFRICOM has carried out. The Pentagon's own inspector general found them to be entirely ineffective. The record in Africa does not look very good, and it is nothing like a model. And I think my central concern is that these bases may be counterproductive to the strategy that they're allegedly being used for. Bases, especially in the Middle East and the greater Middle East, have actually led to radicalization and anti-American sentiment. They've led to the creation of more people willing to take up arms against the United States and U.S. citizens. So I think these bases are really a dangerous development in entrenching this now long-standing collection of bases that, that really should be downsized, not expanded.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Pentagon's proposed new string of military bases from Africa, across the Middle East, and into Southwest Asia, the new envisioned enduring footprint of the U.S. military. It is in a lot of places already, but there's a move now, a push to regularize this, to make this part of a strategy as ISIS has become more of an issue and other threats as well. David Vine is with us, author of Base Nation. Vikram Singh, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, with us from Leesburg, Virginia, in the Center for American Progress. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent who's been reporting on this for the New York Times, author of The Way of the Knife, with us from Washington. You can join us. What do you think? Does more presence make the U.S. more effective or get it tangled in troubles everywhere? And should the U.S. military be like a good ATM network nearby everywhere? Or not? Here's President Obama again at the Pentagon yesterday, met with his top national security advisors there, said that the effort against ISIS is already hurting the terrorist organization.
Since this summer, ISIL has not had a single successful major offensive operation on the ground in either Syria or Iraq. In recent weeks, we've unleashed a new wave of strikes on their lifeline, their oil infrastructure, destroying hundreds of their tankers, trucks, wells, and refineries.
In there, getting close, doing damage, he says, destroying hundreds of those. Ash Carter, Defense Secretary, talking with the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee last week about why using ground forces, U.S. ground forces, against ISIS wouldn't be productive overall.
We certainly have the capability to furnish a U.S. component to such a ground force. We have not recommended this course of action for several reasons. In the medium term, by seeming to Americanize the conflicts in Iraq and Syria, we could well turn those fighting ISIL or inclined to resist their rule into fighting us instead.
Could well bring them into fighting us instead. I want to ask you, Mark Mazzetti, about that. Listeners responding online here. Ann says on Facebook, who said we own the world? Well, okay, but there's security issues. Ari says, will a base in Ethiopia require us to assist the next time Ethiopians go genocidal on Eritreans? Yes, you can get tangled up in local stuff. Chuck says these sound more like precincts than bases. We're trying to police the world, so we need our cops or troops close to the problem. Of course, he's kind of cynical. He says the alternative is to the usual bomb them until there's nothing left every 10 or 20 years. Ouch. Mark Mazzetti, what about Ash Carter saying, look, if we're not careful, if we're too involved ourselves, we could turn these fights into fights against us. Does this proposal come with that risk?
Sure, because what's happening and what is really not discussed very much is the fact that the U.S. is in combat in Syria, in Afghanistan still, and will be in combat in these places where the U.S. sets up bases across West Africa, North Africa. It doesn't it may be called something different by this administration or a future administration. In other words, if if it's special operations troops doing discrete raids, that's of course still combat. It carries risks of death. And yet it's something that does not get discussed because they don't like to talk about boots on the ground in places. But I think there's been this change in the language, which I think is problematic because I think it gives people a false sense of what's actually happening. And I think what's really underlying a lot of this Pentagon plan, of course, is the ability to launch combat operations in a lot of places. It is, of course, training and it's assisting, but it's also carrying out counterterrorism missions. And I think that is sorry to use the cliche, but a new normal that the Pentagon is looking at for some time to come.
Vikram Singh, it is, of course, not new for the U.S. to be abroad in a very big way with big bases in a lot of places. But still, this is looking to regularize even a more intimate presence there, a more widespread presence. What's changed in the world that we're at this point where the sense that the world cannot hang together without a U.S. military presence there, Vikram? I mean, what about the idea of it sort of being, self-powering, not needing U.S. policing everywhere?
Well, it's an interesting question. It is certainly not new. One of the things that has changed is a lot of countries are feeling a lot of insecurity and are welcoming of U.S. partnership and assistance in a way that they wouldn't necessarily be if they didn't feel that there was such a threat and that they actually needed that assistance. You know, it's important to note that we go where we're wanted, and I think one of David's core points is that we should be taking stock of what we're doing around the world and figuring out what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. That really should be something we're constantly doing. And I'm afraid that we really don't do that. There is a tendency to set things up and then they sort of spin along forever rather than getting a hard look at does this really make sense. You know, there has to be a mutual benefit. Having our presence somewhere should be deterring bad guys. It should be reassuring friends and partners. And it should enable us to help them improve their security, and it should enable us to respond and react when we need to. I've negotiated with a lot of countries over the U.S. presence, and I can tell you, for all the potential benefits, there's also always a lot of risk. You can really, a few bad incidents between, U.S. forces in a foreign country and the local population, you know, can really put a relationship into a tailspin. And so you're not doing things without risk. You don't also necessarily need to have an American base. You know, one of the things we don't do as much as I think we should is say, well, what if we just operated and, you know, in partnership off of the host nation's facilities? Perhaps with space for some of our stuff, some of our material, you know, places for our guys to stay. But there's an ability to do that, that I think sometimes we're a little too restrictive on how we partner. We want to go in and have like just a space that's just ours. And, in such a networked world, maybe we should be more flexible about how we help our partners.
David Vine, do you see an irony or a surprise in this expanded network under the years of the Obama administration? There was a kind of come home America message more than implicit in the candidate Obama's campaign for the White House.
Yeah, I see several ironies here. I mean, on the one hand, I'm encouraged that, you know, Ash Carter sees that putting, you know, very large numbers of U.S. troops on the ground will be counterproductive, will lead to people fighting U.S. troops. But unfortunately, the large presence of bases and troops, even if you keep them on the bases, can have the same result, create more terrorists, can build support for ISIS. And I think, you know, this very large infrastructure of bases in and around the Middle East, around 100, as I said, you know, it made it all too easy to go to war in Iraq, which, of course, then led to the creation and helped fuel the growth of ISIS. And I think this plan to continue to expand this infrastructure is likely to, unfortunately, lead to more wars and buys into the idea that there is some military solution to the problem of ISIS when we really do need to seek diplomatic and political solutions, not one based in bases or some sort of military application of force.
Well, that's certainly hotly debated right now. Lila in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. I mean, hotly debated, but I'd say right now more people seem to be saying bring on the force. I don't know if that's the right answer. Lila, Pawleys Island, South Carolina, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I think that our policies and the way that we're handling the war on terrorism is really outdated. I'm equating it with the way that we fight the war on drugs right now, and I think that we need to completely rethink how we handle things. I don't think that it's working at all. I don't think that more troops, more boots on the ground, more bases are going to positively affect us. I think actually it will have the opposite effect.
So what would you do? I mean, there's clearly a challenge there. It looks like, you know, John Kerry, everyone's saying this could become dire if it's not dealt with. So what would you do?
Well, what are we doing right now that's having any positive influence on them? I don't think that we're doing anything. I think that we need to look at it in a different way. I think that these are a new wave of terrorists. I think that we need to think about how they're younger, how they're more savvy, and mm-hmm. we need to use, you know, creativity. We need to use intelligence. We need to use technology to fight them. Just like we have, you know, the internet groups Anonymous, why don't we deploy more things like that? Why don't we recruit young college hackers, use different tactics than we're using because they're obviously not working. I mean, we, quote-unquote, got rid of Al-Qaeda or we, you know, we killed Osama bin Laden. But all that did was branch off and create more terrorists.
Lila, I like it. Let's get creative. There's no question. That's always a good idea. Let me hold the thought of how much can be accomplished on that front, or maybe just by shifting to that view of the world. Let me hold that, if I may. Greg in Akron, Ohio. Greg, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My question is more, what does the new bases accomplish that the American carrier battle groups don't in the projection of American sovereignty and American power? And also the base for our quick reaction forces and the SEAL teams and Delta Force and other Tier 1 and Tier 2 operators, isn't this just more infrastructure that we have to maintain and keep in place for limited viability versus having a carrier group that can respond to anywhere in the world for any crisis situation?
Greg, let us pick it up. Mark Mazzetti first on the carrier. Then I want to come to Lila's point. But what about we've got aircraft carriers out there? Why not just do it from sea?
Sure, and the U.S. does that now. You know, you've got a certain number of carrier groups. You've got a certain number of ships that need to be all over the world for their various assignments. And so, you know, when you've got a carrier, even if one in the middle of the Mediterranean, there could be a crisis that's pretty far to get to from a carrier. I think certainly the idea of doing it more at sea versus the permanent bases is something that is discussed. It is a very legitimate option because there are real downsides to having permanent or semi-permanent bases. I think the Pentagon is looking at that. In their view, having these smaller footprints just gets you closer to where you might have to be. And again, it wouldn't necessarily mean, you know, a permanent stationing of thousands of troops. You could have stationing of material in places and rotating special operations troops or intelligence operatives through places on a semi-permanent basis with the expectation that, you know, that they could get there quickly or stage in advance of a major crisis. These are things that are still being worked out now, but I think the Pentagon is seeing the idea of just using things at sea, carrier groups, as lacking.
Lila, I'm still holding that thought of a strategic shift here. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Tom. If we're going to build more military bases, I think we're assuming that ISIS is going to be around for at least 10 more years. And I would hope that we would have the ISIS problem at least controlled in less than 10 years.
Duly noted. Let us pick it up. Jim, thank you for your call. Vikram Singh, you hear Jim. He says, if you're putting in bases, it sounds like at least a 10-year commitment, and he wants ISIS solved well before that. What are the prospects for that? And then I hope you heard our earlier caller, Lila, saying, what about a different approach entirely here that's not so gun-related? We've seen failures of that as well as some successes, but failures. What about something more creative?
So I would go back to one of David's earlier points, which is, first of all, I don't think you can blame conflicts that emerge or things that we get engaged in on having a presence. I think that goes a little bit too far.
That's a pretty huge statement. David Vine is not alone in saying going to war in Iraq has had enormous consequences,
right?
Outcomes.
I'm just saying I don't think we went to war in Iraq because we had a network of bases. I think there were many other political reasons that we went to war in Iraq. I don't think you can say we put a base in and then we will have some force of gravity that pulls us into a strategic mistake. But I do think that he's exactly right on it. That it does run the risk of having you have too military an approach. First of all, ISIS is going to be around for a while, or the successor of ISIS. I think it is fair to say that the sort of extremist terrorism we're facing now is not a near-term problem. This is going to be a long fight against these kinds of forces. One of the problems, though, is we know bombing does a little. It might be necessary in terms of disrupting leadership and plots and things like that, but it will not fix that problem. I worked very intimately, of course, on Afghanistan and Pakistan for many years, and the fact is we did disrupt Al-Qaeda in the ungoverned areas of Pakistan, but those are still ungoverned areas, and that is the real challenge. It is how do countries ensure that they're able to extend governance, control, take care of the needs of people in all of their territory, and you won't have this kind of ungoverned space where terrorists or, quite frankly, criminals, for example, in parts of Mexico or South America or other places, can control large pieces of territory. I think a much smaller focused effort where you're partnering with countries and you're helping them meet their own needs, not just yours, not just your narrow security interests, but your common interests, I think that can be very useful. I also think it can be, I also think it can be done badly. So we have to think about how we're doing it. What we did with Colombia over many, many years, more than 15 years, or what we did in the Philippines over a dozen or so years in the southern Philippines, those have led eventually to actually to peace processes, and we are seeing a potential peace process in Colombia. And so I think if we're looking at something that takes us that direction, we're potentially getting back to a sustainable and smart approach. But it's not just military. It's all elements of what the United States can do to help other countries.
Mark Mazzetti, do you see an Obama White House sign-off on this coming, or does it really need that? Will the Pentagon essentially roll on into this whether or not there's a formal sign-off?
I think they'd like an Obama administration sign-off, and I think that the White House probably will sign off on this or a variation of it. And I think that kind of what you're going back to here is, again, they might be not using that language at the White House, and they might be avoiding that language. But, this notion of this global war on terror that you heard about after 9/11, I think that the Obama administration is starting to think of the rise of ISIS and its affiliates as something akin to that. And they're probably going to give the military what it wants to fight that.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent with the New York Times, author of The Way of the Knife. Thank you for your reporting and your insights today, Mark. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
David Vine, author of Base Nation and Island of Shame. David Vine in Vicenza, Italy. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thank you, Tom.
And Vikram Singh, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, now at the Center for American Progress. Vikram, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tom. Real pleasure.
Watch this space. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. iTunes has named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. We hope you'll subscribe and follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.